This is the Shift Podcast.
Today on the Shift Daily Podcast, 12 guys walk into a bar and they bought it. It's not a joke. Tim Sangha, co-owner of the Scarlet Ibis Pub, tells us a story about he and his biker buddies fell in love with a pub in the middle of nowhere on Vancouver Island and they bought it. We finally have made a fusion power breakthrough. Greg Fish in the World of Weird Things tries to explain fusion power and how it won't blow us up. And plus, are you okay with Pele, a walrus, and how about moving? All of this and more on the Shift Daily Podcast. Thanks for being here. Okay, so I imagine this is how this happened. Okay, you've been with your buddies, right? You've been sitting around with your buddies, your friends, your girlfriends, your guy friends, whatever. And you're sitting around the table, had a couple of drinks, and then you've got that one friend. You've got that one friend who says that phrase that everybody cringes. You know what we should do? That's the phrase. And this is the phrase that gets people in trouble. Because usually at this point, it's not a good idea.
Well, you know what? And that's what we had told Pat, who was the old owner. We said, you know what? We're not interested in buying a bar after she had let us in on that particular Sunday. But yeah. And then all of a sudden we come home and we were still drinking.
We weren't even home yet. We were stopped on the way, one of the bars on the way back.
Yeah.
Stopped at another bar. Yeah. Oh my God.
Another bar.
Okay. So let me reset this for everybody so everyone knows. Okay. So who you hear in the background is Tim, Al, and Russ. They are partners with a few other friends in a place that really was an accident. Yeah. So here's the story. Now, correct me, guys, if I get this wrong, is that you guys basically went on a fella's trip. You stopped in at a pub. It was closed. The owner was like, oh, sure, I'll feed you, whatever. I'll get you wet. And then you guys ended up jokingly saying we should buy the bar. Turns out you did. And a bunch of buddies bought a bar. I mean, that's as cliche as, you know, three friends walk into a bar jokes. But you did it. Yeah, and it's working.
So far.
Okay, so tell everybody, let's reset because we have listeners all across Canada. Not everybody knows the island. Can you navigate us if we were, say, leaving Victoria, where all of this little adventure happens?
Well, it started in Gold River for the bike ride. And basically 4 days or 3 days before we got up to where the pub was, we've just been kind of off-roading all the time and just stopped in. So you're basically the opposite end of the island from Victoria.
Yeah. So we're at the from Port Hardy Shane, we are about 45
kilometers.
About 45 kilometers where the pub is situated, which wow. Makes us the most remote pub on Vancouver Island, and we've been told that we might be the most remote pub in BC due to certain geographical lines, but we haven't pursued that. So
yeah,
so that's happened. So,
but there was another pub in Haida Gwaii, was it, or something?
Yeah,
that came up, and
that's right.
They were like, I think we're the most, you can measure it, I suppose.
Yeah.
But how do you tell from where?
You know what, it's funny, we had someone actually contact us and say, you guys should fight for the most remote pub, because you know, this person went online and they did all the calculations and they said, I'm pretty sure that you're more remote, but we're waiting for them to send us some information so we can see if we actually are or not.
Yeah. Well, it is remote. That is not up for debate. And it is kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
So first of all, a bunch of friends buying a bar is, you know, not a great business plan.
Nope.
Just saying. But you guys actually have a bit of a mixed bag of trades and tools behind you because, you know, you guys, so everyone kind of takes on a little bit different things. So from that perspective, it kind of works.
Like this, just kind of it's an adventure in its own, right?
Because
that's cool.
Yeah. Cause so Shane, so the bar one day, hopefully will make money, but that, you know, I think that collectively our dream was to keep the bar going because the community needs it for their social interaction. We are also the emergency preparedness center for the area as well. So in case of a tsunami, or a road closure, then people stay with us until it's safe to travel back to the Port Hardy area. And that's happened. It hasn't happened since we've had the bar, but it has happened in the past.
Yeah, so there's some community investment, really, that's what goes on. I mean, it's not like you just bought a bar and a pool table, right, and a dartboard.
No, we actually have dartboards.
Although, two dartboards. I got to call you out a little bit because you sound a little bit like the prime minister when you say the budget of the bar will balance itself, which is funny.
Ouch. Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll be paying for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you're going to lose money for 7 years if nothing else. Well, so this is cool because now you've gone and you've invested in the community. You guys are island folks anyway, and you have done so much more. I mean, even the lager that's named after the lager, L-A-U versus the L-O-G-G. Yeah. Like, you guys have done quite a bit when it comes to just the identity and character of the island, the north end of the island. I mean, this is really kind of fun. You guys realizing that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity to kind of create with this and have a good time and live into it a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, our goal, I mean, we're almost there now where we have more time to go and enjoy the area, because that's been a problem for us, because we're always, when we go up, the team is busy working and fixing stuff, and we're not hiking and seeing the area as much as we'd like, but you know, we see light at the end of the
tunnel. We see the goal there.
Yeah. Yeah. We're almost there.
Well, isn't that what it's like for most people when they have a cottage or something like that? I mean, so many, when we used to have we had a family lake house in Northern Alberta, and that's what it was, right? Like, how was your vacation? Well, how was my vacation? I mean, I built a deck, I tore down a fence, I moved a tree, I fixed the outboard motor on the boat, right? I patched the kayak.
Yeah.
You know, did you do anything? I don't think I even sat down for a minute, but that's kind of the way these things work.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. You know what? We actually all, like, well, the three of us here and the other active members of the group like to be busy. And, you know, when we go up there, we're there to get, you know, we have a list of items that we have to get done before we leave. And that's what we get done. And that's been the reason for our success, I think, is that we are
proactive.
Yeah, we are proactive. Like
we're a team, eh?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Well, that's the next question, was friend. Like, how long you guys been friends for? Because, I mean, you don't typically go into this with, like, someone you don't know, and then you're not organized. Like, you have to have good relationships to be organized and be able to say, hey, by the way, you know, hey, Al, if you're going up this weekend, can you take care of this, right?
Yeah.
Like, so are you guys new friends, old friends? How does
that
start?
We're all pretty much, you know, I'd say half is new, half is old. You know, when we started this thing, so there was myself and Roy, he's one of the other partners, he and I were sort of talking about it and Russ and Al, and we came up with, what do we need to have to make this work? So we needed to have certain tradespeople to, fix problems as they arise. So we picked our friends that had certain skill sets. So that's what we did. We picked a carpenter, an electrician, a gas guy, a millwright, a handyman, a banker, a marketing guy. So that way we're not tripping over each other as far as what we can bring to the table. So we were able to put this team together, and all 12 people said yes. This is, you know, kind of surprising, but maybe not really, because of who we are as people.
Oops, everyone agreed.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Yeah. Okay, you know, I guess we're going to pull the trigger.
And we also, like, Russ and Tim have been friends for years, but Tim and I became friends when we did a trip, because we all love motorcycling. This is how we found the pub. It's part of the Vancouver 1000. Tim and I traveled back from Southern Argentina, Southern Chile, all the way back to Nanaimo. That big trip back in 2017. And so you gain really good friendships. You get to know a guy. You just, it's a bond. It was a win-win. And meeting all the other partners like Roy and us, we're all really tight guys, eh? We just love each other.
Yeah, well, that's that's really what I kind of heard, right? Is that, you know, is the motorcycle aspect of that, the bond of that, is that really the key? Because there's something about motorcycle folks, right? That y'all do the strangest things. You know, everyone has a reputation about
You know what?
While cruising down the highway.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. It's a motorcycle bond. I mean, it's a weird thing, but we've been riding together, you know, me and my buddies for, you know, for a bunch of years. And you know, the motorcycle is the
common key.
Is the catalyst for all of
them.
You know, and
well, and sense of community too, right? That's a big one. It's all motorcycle guys. It's always sense of community, even in the guys that, you know, break the law, like those guys, they're still sense of community, right? Like there really is a bond, versus the ordinary motorcycle guys that are doing Santa Claus teddy bear runs and all these other things that happen, right? Like there's something special about that. And it seems to be a bit of a perfect storm. Forgive the bad example, or metaphor, but when it comes to the north end of the island, to take a bunch of guys with a sense of community at the core, put them in a small community that has to have a sense of community as its core. And that's a pretty good fit.
Absolutely. You know, talk about the perfect storm. I'll just give you a quick story. When we were up there, we first bought the pub. We were grading all the land because we were going to put in some accommodation for our clients so they can stay there overnight. So we're getting ready to do all the infrastructure work for the parking lot to run the power and the water to the adventure huts, which are where people can stay. And then we happen to have a big hurricane force winds come in, and on the other side of the property, which is about 250-300 feet away from where the huts were going, we had a big wind come in and pick up a metal shed, blew it up over the pub, and then wrapped it around a bunch of trees. A big tree. We had to get one of the machines, like an excavator, in to actually pull it off the tree. It wrapped it right around. Like, it was insane.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Billy Green Giant had done it himself.
But up there, you get a lot of fierce winds and rains, and it gets a little crazy up there.
And when, you know, we went up there and first took over the pub, the rumor in Holberg went around that you hear a bunch of bikers bought the pub.
They thought
people didn't know what to think, because they hadn't met us yet, because we'd only, Pat let us in on the day she was shut. And I'm sure she was, you know, doing all she could to wind us in there. I guess it worked. But the locals, I think, for the most part, I mean, I think that what kind of guys we are, we're adventure riders on our motorcycles.
I think at first it was a little tough for them and that, but they've all taken us in, and like, we're kind of like family now.
Yeah. A lot of them. And we're all really involved in keeping the area clean and safe and environmentally friendly. And I think that's because it's so beautiful and pristine up there. It's so remote that people don't realize that if you want to go somewhere and hear no sound, once the bar is shut, that's the place to be.
Well, you see, like,
I love that. Once the bar is closed.
What beautiful beach can you camp on the beach nowadays?
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah.
Whereas up there, you can, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's still a very special place. Yeah. You know, we have a lot of people that are coming from Tofino, like, you know, like young people that are into surfing and stuff. And they all liken it to the fact that this is like Tofino was 50 or 60 years ago.
20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean,
because it's still commercialized now.
But just so you know, it's a rough ride out to the pub. So,
not always.
You know, just take your time. Follow the signs, and you can't miss us.
I'm looking at the map now. Like, it is literally like as far as far north.
Yeah,
like that's far. Holy cow!
On the way to San Joe Bay, and San Joe Bay last year was voted the number one nature beach in Canada.
Really? Well, how far is it from? How far is it from Tofino then?
Well, from Tofino,
5 hours, 4 hours. Oh, well, you can't even get that
as the crow flies, only probably 200 or 300 kilometers, like a couple.
Yeah, but
oh, it's like Port Alice north.
Yeah,
holy cow.
Port Alice.
Yeah, so yeah, it's definitely quite a ways. I mean, we're getting a lot of younger people that like to camp in their vans, like van life type people, and they're coming through and they're going surfing and hiking, and they can't believe how pristine it's still.
Yeah, a beautiful beach there too is
Grant's.
There's Grant Bay, but there's also Raft Cove, which is unreal. I mean, the surfing there is to die for, and a lot of the surfer guys come up, girls in the summer, and they float down the Mac Jack River with their stuff. There's camping there. There's fresh water. But when you look at those rollers coming in, it's absolutely stunning.
Can you fly there, by the way?
You can do a float plane. A float plane from Nanaimo to there is very expensive. It's like $5,000.
Yeah, we'll pick you up if you want to come.
Yeah.
You should fly out. We'll take you up. We'll take you up there.
It's the Scarlet Ibis Pub and Restaurant. And so tell me about the beers. North Coast Trail Ale, which you do for so a little proceeds to trail system support.
Yeah.
And then the Redbird Lager, which I think is, I mean, that's dynamite genius. As a guy who's worked in marketing and media for a quarter of a century, having the Redbird Lager, but spelling it L-O-G-G-E-R, that's pretty wicked. So tell me about the beers. And yeah. I mean,
you know, it was, so we have some of our friends, Tracy and Harley from the Longwood Brewery. We needed someone to partner with to create a beer for us. And so the synergistic partnership with them was just natural. And so they make our beers for us, and we have both beers on tap and as well as in the cans. And it's been fabulous. It's been very well received. I think so far, I think we've got around $1,300 or $1,400 that we've donated, or that we're about to make a donation sometime this year to the North Coast Trail System. And yeah, they're just been great because, you know, it's very difficult, as you probably know, to create like a brewery type situation. So that wasn't going to work for us. So our partnership with the Longwood has been awesome. And Harley and Tracy over there have just been great partners. Yeah, really good people.
For sure. It's Longwood. I did look them up too. It's longwoodbeer.com. For everyone else, the Shifthead community of people, we have a Facebook page. So I'll post the link to scarletibis.ca on there so everyone can check it out and see what it's all about and go learn. And guys, like, you have literally made like every group of dudes dream sort of happen, like regardless. We've all been there. We've all sat there and said, we should do this. And like mine, you know what mine is? Mine is like, I want like a 70s Lincoln, like the boxy old ones. I don't even care which model, but I want to cut the top off with a grinder and I want to drive around like roller coasters.
Yeah, that's the kind of car that even comes with the guy in the trunk.
Yeah, right? Well, that may be where we'll be sleeping. But literally drive until it dies and go on that kind of road trip, right? Like this is the kind of thing that you're talking about. And here you are, you've done it. And congratulations on the hard work.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it, Shane.
Thank you so much. And just to let you know that too, like we're always there because sometimes, you know, people get stranded and we're there to help if they can get a hold of us. A lot of times I've been out before, suggested to a couple of young fellows when they were there, if they got into trouble, please get a hold of the pub and I'll come and rescue you. And sure enough, some old guy came in about 8 o'clock at night and said, is there an owl guy here? And there's two young guys way down in the middle of nowhere. Their truck in the ditch. They said that they should come and get me. So anyway, I'm really not really impressed I said that, but I was. So anyway, but we've made two great friends out of that. The young guys that came and they were stranded for days. They helped us out. And, you know, it's really good to help out.
Love it.
Pretty wonderful feeling.
Yeah. I love it. Well, congratulations, guys. Tim, Alan, Russ, just a small group of folks that thought they would buy the most remote bar on Vancouver Island, Scarlet Ibis. Pretty cool. Thanks so much, fellas. Great. It's a pleasure to meet you. Hey,
well, you know, we tried to buy a flying saucer, but there wasn't one available. All your listeners, Yeah. Hi from the Scarlet Ibis.
Thanks so much. Yeah, Happy New Year. And let's see if they want to come up for a visit and have the experience of the most remote pub.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Thanks, buddy. Take care. Happy New Year.
This is the Shift Podcast.
Weird.
It got very weird.
I don't understand.
Welcome to the world of weird things with Greg Fish.
Even more mysterious than the stories he tells is when he shows up in some hidden location and does not join our Zoom call. That's a very world of weird things to do, Greg Fish.
Well, you know, got to keep you on your toes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Happy New Year, brother. I haven't talked to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you as well. Hope it was good. I mean, we've had a couple very interesting years here, and hopefully this one's better.
Yeah. There was a great meme that someone posted at shiftheads.ca. It was basically a side view of two cars about to go into a tunnel, and the first car was 2022. It was a flatbed truck with outhouses on the back that were too tall to go into the tunnel. And then behind it was a convertible that said 2023 with the top down. And so the implication was that 2022 is about to drive into a tunnel that's too small and splash outhouse poop all over someone in a convertible. God, I hope that doesn't happen. I hope we're in good shape. I mean, if you can have a world weird thing story about that, that would be great.
You know, I don't want to ruin the good joke with optimism. Plus, optimism for me sounds a little weird, so I'm just going to let this one go.
Yeah, fair enough. Can you do me a favor and just turn your headphones down just a smidge, bud? We have a little bit of an echo there. Okay, sharing the article, worldofweirdthings.com. It is a podcast. It's a blog. It's got so many great things on there. It will be at shiftheads.ca. By the way, I'm a little afraid here with Fusion Fish. Out of my lane, where are we going?
So we are going to talk about the news that kind of really excited the popular science community, the fusion community, that the National Ignition Facility in California, hey, that's where I live, actually achieved net gain on a fusion test. They put in 2.05 megajoules of energy with a laser, and they got back 3.15 megajoules, which is, hey, this is perfect. This is net gain. We finally have a net positive from a fusion reaction. Everybody celebrate, right?
No. Terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No.
You've told me too many stories about black holes, man, for this to get me excited anymore.
Oh, no. That's not where we're going with this. No, the problem is that although the result looks really nice on paper, what's really happened is that they kind of just omitted the fact that to charge the lasers, they need to use something like 430 or 450 megajoules. So we actually did not get a net gain on the entire system's input. So there's still a lot of work to be done. But at the same time, this is actually a great result for one very simple reason. Okay. It's because before the shot was actually done, the laboratory simulated what they thought the break-even point was, and they found that, okay, we thought that the break-even point was 5 megajoules, but it's actually just over 2 megajoules. So what that tells us is at this point, our simulations are getting more accurate. Because before, what happened is you run all the simulations, you actually do the test shot, and what do you know? Something's not quite right. The results don't quite match up. We're not really sure why this is the case. So this is the first time that we're really seeing those simulations of how fusion reactions are supposed to go, how the plasma is supposed to behave, and actually seeing them play out in the real world, more or less how we see in the simulations. And the reason why this is so important is because fusion research is severely underfunded, so they can't really afford to do experiment after experiment after experiment after experiment.
So let's reset this conversation, Greg Fish, into what exactly are we talking about? A tiny little fusion reactor that we would put in our house or in our car that would have enough power to do everything that we do without having to use wires and stuff? Or are we talking about a power plant that's in the USS Enterprise?
Right now, we're talking about a power, something that's a power plant-sized deal. I mean, ideally, in the very far future, you could have your own tiny little fusion reactor that powers everything, but we're nowhere near there yet. Right now, we're talking about something like, imagine the, you know, those giant nuclear power plants or those huge coal power plants. We're talking about something about that size. But the idea is something that size would replace all of these coal plants, all of these nuclear fission plants, and would work in tandem with solar and with wind to provide steady, reliable energy for entire cities.
That's funny because solar and wind don't provide steady energy, but that's I get what you're saying. So what's the difference then between nuclear fission and fusion? Because I think that has me confused, and I'm assuming I'm not alone.
So the difference is actually immense. So nuclear fission, you have very large, very heavy atoms that you break apart. And as they break apart and start a chain reaction, they release heat. You capture that heat, use it to spin turbines and get and generate energy that way. Fusion, you are taking isotopes of hydrogen, usually deuterium and tritium. And you can do two things. The first is what the NIF did, which is something called inertial confinement fusion, which is where you essentially have a lasers firing in all directions on a fuel pellet that contains those the gases of those two isotopes. They create helium. They lose a little bit of mass in the process. That mass gets converted to pure energy, and that's what you are going to use to generate the electricity. And or there's another version, which is essentially a donut-shaped reactor where you spin plasma around. You start introducing that gas into those plasma reactions, and the longer it spins, the more energy it produces as well, also from creating helium, converting a little bit of basically smashing atoms together to lose a little bit of mass. That mass gets converted into energy. You capture that, you stream into the grid.
Wow. Okay, so smaller, more efficient, no spent nuclear rods, I'm assuming, just some laser beams to kickstart it?
No, yeah, just some laser beams, just some plasma. The other very nice thing about it is that it can't melt down, because if something goes wrong, if the reaction breaks down, you just get the little fizzle of plasma, and that's it. The reactor just shuts down.
Really? So, but then it's self-sustaining once it starts?
It's not really self-sustaining per se. There's cycles that it can do on its own, but you kind of have to keep it going, which is actually exactly what you want, because you can shut down the reaction anytime it becomes unstable. And ideally, you don't want it to just keep going without your input, because anything that you can keep going without your input has the potential to become something pretty menacing, because you build up a lot of potential energy. This is what happens with fission reactors, and this is why they have to be super carefully controlled. This is why it's possible to have meltdowns with them. So this is completely opposite technology.
Okay. So then what's the benefit then? I mean, if it's not just like free power, like an extension cord from the sun scenario, what's the benefit?
Well, the benefit is it's right now it's not free power, and it's not really going to be free power. But essentially what it is a tiny little bit of mass from very easily accessible isotopes, things that we can find in the wild, or we can just generate from seawater, which we have plenty of. You can generate a ton of energy from it. You don't have spent nuclear fuel, as we talked about. We don't have long-lasting radioactive products. And you have pretty safe, convenient energy when we actually get all of these things properly working.
Okay. Good deal. So why don't we do it now? Why haven't they? Why is it so underfunded? You said it was underfunded, Greg. Why is it underfunded?
It's underfunded for two reasons. Reason number one is that people really wanted it to actually work already. Partially what happened was that a lot of scientists thought they were a lot closer to fusion than they were about 30, 40 years ago. They made a lot of very big promises. Those promises didn't pan out. So a lot of politicians basically say, well, why should approve? Why should we approve something that doesn't work? So that was one big part of it. But the other part of it is that it's not a priority. It's a very complicated technology. No one knows exactly when we will be able to hit that point where we can commercialize it and who's going to own the rights and what's going to happen from that point on. So a lot of politicians are kind of loath to invest in it. A lot of private companies are very loath to invest in it because right now we're just now starting to see positive results. We're now just starting to get these things on track. So hopefully as more and more good results come in, the purse strings will open up. We'll be able to do more experiments. We'll be able to do them faster. But right now, essentially the idea is it's unproven technology and no one wants to risk it.
So what's next, Greg Fish? Fusion, power, little power reactors that are in our houses. I mean, what comes next from this? How soon and when? What does it look like?
So the next thing is ITER, which is a giant reactor that's being built in Europe. And its entire purpose is to demonstrate that fusion is possible, sustainable, can produce way more energy than we can put in, than the system requires to put in to kickstart the fusion reaction. And then figure out how do we actually capture this energy? How do we commercialize it? How do we run a fusion power plant? It's being assembled now. It's actually getting close to final stages of assembly. In the next few years, it's going to start burning plasma through the reactor to get things warmed up and test all the magnets and everything else. And then hopefully, if everything goes to plan, by the mid to late 2030s, we will actually be able to see net gain, consistent fusion reactions, and start really planning the next big steps after that.
Okay, so we got an interesting text here. It says, when they get this nuclear reactor, or when they get this fusion reactor down to the portable size, I'm going to need a DeLorean. Is this flux capacitor level stuff that we're talking about here once it gets that small?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. The idea for something like that would be you would be able to create something that's a very small antimatter catalyzed fusion reactor. And if you have something that's that small and that portable, it would really change a lot of things. I mean, you would essentially have your own private power plant for your home or for your car or for your interstellar spaceship or whatever. It would be a tremendous game changer if we got it miniaturized to that level.
Wow. So I guess that's the end goal then. Not to be too back to the futurey, great Scott, but if we were to, you know, be putting banana peels into the back of our DeLorean, wouldn't that be the ideal scenario?
Oh, well, it's even easier than that. We'd just be pouring a little bit of water in our DeLoreans and it basically bends the laws of time and space when we push a button.
Oh, that's all. Because we need that. Because we can't even handle zipper lanes right now.
Well, yeah, that would be somewhat problematic. I see where you're coming from there. So we probably need wider lanes. Maybe, you know, give someone a little bit more room to merge because they will be doing it at some percentage of the speed of light. So I understand the hesitation right there.
Some percentage of the speed of light. Okay, nerd man, seeing you're so incognito here with you're hiding from us on the Zoom call and all things suspicious, I'm going to get suspicious then. So what do you get most excited about this, Fish? Because, I mean, you are the uber nerd in this. I mean, that is a compliment. What really is the big deal here? Like, really?
Yeah, really. I think the big deal about all of this is that we're finally starting to really test revolution technologies that have been promised to us a very long time ago. And I think the really exciting part for me is that the researchers who are involved in this didn't give up. They didn't just look at a bunch of failed experiments and say, you know what, I'm just going to forget it. I'm going to go do something else. This is probably impossible. No, they looked at the numbers. They saw that it should be possible. They stuck with it. And now they're getting consistent results. So that dogged pursuit of a technology that we know for a fact, if we can make it work, it would be life-changing in the best way possible. It would really tremendously help us out to clean up the world, to explore space, to do all sorts of really amazing things. They didn't give up, and that's something I find incredibly inspiring about this entire story. And the fact that now we're starting to get consistent results from simulations. We're starting to get experiments from test reactors that are showing us, yes, this is possible. We're getting close. We're really on the doorstep of actually making this work. It could be within our lifetimes. It could be possible to see major reactors, not something miniaturized. That might be a very long way away, but maybe within our lifetimes we'll see a fusion reactor powering a city. Like, that's just, like I said, I have no other word for it but inspiring.
But are you sure we're not missing something here, Fish? Because when they told us we were going digital and it was a paperless society, no one mentioned that, by the way, you still got to print everything out and save it. And then, by the way, you need four different computer backups and it uses more electricity. When they said nuclear power is just like endless power, they didn't tell us that, by the way, these rods, when they're done, are terrible and so is the water, right? Like, nobody told us these things. And maybe I'm just pessimistic or skeptical at this point, but I feel like there's some sort of gotcha at the end of this conversation. No one told us when they put up wind turbines that, by the way, the fans are not even reusable or recyclable and we're going to bury them. It's more waste than anything else, right? Like, no one told us 20 years ago when they started solar in California and they were doing all these incentives that, by the way, the lifespans are really short and it's going to be really expensive for you to get new ones and we have nowhere to put the old ones. Like, there's always been a gotcha. What am I missing here?
They're definitely going to be growing pains. Like, at this point, I don't think anyone can tell you exactly what they are, but we know they're going to be growing pains. But part of the issue with any new technology is that sometimes people get ahead of themselves and they are so focused on getting technology out there. It takes a few iterations. It takes a few generations of the technology to work out some of these kinks and to say, okay, no, we actually have to address it. So I do think that it's very fair that before we actually try to commercialize it, before we actually start trying to build fusion power plants based on hopefully positive results from ITER, to ask, okay, well, how are we actually going to run this? What does the plan look like? What are some of the potential hazards? Because you're absolutely right. Now, with the nuclear, we did know that contamination was going to be a problem. But one of the big things that happened there is that the people who created the technology rushed because they saw, oh, we can make this work really quickly. I think we can handle it. Let's just get it out there. We'll figure it out later. It's the same thing with how some of the wind turbines were created, with some of the solar panels were created. Okay, we created it. Let's get it out there. Let's get it working. We'll fix it later. And I do think it's fair to say, well, before we start changing how the world gets its power, let's work out later now. Let's work out what end of life looks like. Let's work out what all the gotchas are. Let's work out all the little kinks so we know exactly what's happening and why and what we can do about it.
Yeah, because it's so important, man, because it's got us so many times. It gets us even now with electric cars, right? I mean, I don't think there's anybody who wishes that we could have more responsible driving and impact and all those things. But, you know, power grids and batteries and all the minerals in the batteries, all these things, like, we are way ahead of ourselves when it comes to putting these things together. Promising. But boy, oh boy, like, we screw this up over and over again, Fish. And when we're talking about fusion and all these tiny little, like, our own star in our closet, I mean, that goes wrong real quick.
Well, like I said, in this particular case, it's not the actual reaction, because if something goes wrong, that can be shut down very easily. It's more about what does the magnet life cycle look like? For how long do they last? How often do you need to replace them? Are some of the elements recyclable in those magnets? So those would be kind of like, what happens as we maintain the reactor? What happens to all these parts and pieces that we're going to replace and swap out? I think that would be something that we need to take care of. And you're right, there's a long history of rushing into getting things set up and then figuring out, oh, there's all these long-term effects that we didn't actually consider. But the big question becomes is that when you have a lot of private companies that are in charge of that, who make sure that they follow up on this? Because if they say, hey, you know, this is better and we will figure out all the kinks later, who holds them accountable to that? That's a completely different discussion. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a discussion that's worth having, but I feel like when we start talking about some of these things, they go a little bit beyond the scope of what we're covering here.
Yeah. Well, and that's fantastic, though, because that's what we run into again and again. It really is. I mean, is exactly that, is that who's going to hold this into account and make sure that it's all done properly? Greg Fish, worldofweirdthings.com. The link to the article is posted at shiftheads.ca. Mysterious man who's not at home. He's hiding somewhere. Thanks, Fishy. Happy New Year, brother.
You too. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
This is the Shift Podcast.
Let's get started with this.
Are you okay with
shopping for rental properties? No, it's terrible, Ryan.
I hate it. It's so up and down because, you know, you're looking for specific things, a location and, you know, very simple amenities. And the prices just don't really reflect what you would think you'd have to pay. And then you go, okay, I'll lower my price. And then all of a sudden, all of the things you want are now on the outskirts of the city, and they're still not at the price you want. And so it is very frustrating until it isn't and you find the perfect place, which has been my experience every single time I've tried to find a place to live.
Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful for the place that I rent now because, you know, my landlord's awesome. I mean, I'll give a great example about how awesome. It's kind of Good News Tuesday. Here's a good News Tuesday story about my landlord. His name's Scott. And the previous tenant, they built this place, this townhouse, and then the previous tenant was in here 6 years. I've been in here 5 years now. So they've had a pretty good run, right? And the garage door broke a couple of days ago, like on the 31st or the 30th. And what happened was, is I didn't know this. I just learned this weekend, that garage doors have a life cycle. And the most important breaking part of a garage door, according to the garage door repair guy, is the counterweight coil. So a garage door is very, very heavy. And the garage door opener is not that powerful. So what they do is they torque up a spring, which counter pulls the door up automatically with the torque on the spring. Right. So just not quite enough to lift the door. So when you go to lift the door with the motor, the door's quite light because it's got a spring that's actually unwinding that helps take the weight. Well, what happens is the metal in that spring breaks down. The number that the guy gave me was, you know, 10,000 twists. So 10,000 openings, which is a long time if you think about it. And as I talked to Scott about it, Scott was like, oh, yeah, that happened at my house. No big deal. Just get it done. This is the kind of guy. So rent was due 3 days ago, right? Garage door is not going to be fixed until later this afternoon. And he basically said, well, if you don't mind taking care of it, it'll save me the trouble in trying to coordinate it anyway. Just make it happen and then take it off rent and then just send in the rent when after the door is fixed. Like, that's the kind of guy he is. Like, that's good, amazing human landlord stuff, right? So I'm paying the same amount, and I'm helping him out because I'm getting it done. I'm taking on making the phone calls and getting the guy and meeting the guy. He doesn't have to come here. So that's cool. I'm going to be here anyway. So I help him out, and then he's just like, how about you just take it off the rent and then don't worry about it? I mean, I don't mind doing that. I would have to be here anyway, so what's the big deal? I get to pick the time. So, like, that's good. But trying to find a place, I'm considering leaving because it's just me and the house hippo here. In this three-bedroom townhouse, because the kids are, you know, my son graduates this year, my daughter graduates next year. They're gone. They're never here. They pop in and out, and usually they show up with four friends when they show up, right? So, I mean, it's just life-changing. That's what happens. Anyone who's got kids that grow up, they start to change. So, you know, where am I going to move to? What am I going to do? All those things are sort of, you know, well, if I'm going to be paying this much, I might as well be in a place that, you know, that's close to what I want. So I'm not okay with that. It's tough. It's a whole new world going from being a homeowner to being, you know, a renter again and going through all that stuff. Boy, but I still have compassion for the homeowners because the amount you're paying in interest rates and everything else now, boy, that stuff, whew, not good. Anyway, don't know how we do it, but here we are. Tis the thing. I offered Ryan, by the way, shift heads so he could come and move in here, but he's too far away from the cool people.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
yep, that's it.
That's it.
Are you okay with Pele? We probably should ask Uncle Leo this question.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Since he's in downtown Vancouver. Leo, are you okay with Pele?
Yeah, of course. I mean, he's bigger than our country itself. Where I came from. That's what I've been watching since Thursday when he passed. The funeral was a couple of days ago and lasted 24 hours. Like, it ended this morning here, like Pacific time. Mm-hmm. There was like over almost 300,000 people showed up in the 24 hour span. And it's just, it's great. I was having this conversation here, like in the hallways here in CKNW Vancouver, because everybody was sending condolences to me, right? Even though I never met the guy, but it was like, you know, you may not know anything like about Brazil. You may not know where Brazil is. You may not know like where we speak Portuguese or how our culture is or whatever. But everybody knows like who Pelé is. And
well, they've heard of him, right?
They've heard of him. A guy was as famous as the Beatles, as Jesus Christ, and everybody knows who he was, who he is, and everybody knew also that he was from Brazil. So in a way, he was the big ambassador. So,
well, you know what's cool about that is that after Messi's success with the World Cup this year, and that sort of question, is Messi belong in the same realm as Pelé and these other athletes? It's cool that Pelé made it that long to see that, right? I realize it's Argentina, it's not Brazil, but it's in the neighborhood, and the conversation about some of the best, hopefully lucid enough to be around it. But really cool stuff. Well, the Brazilian soccer great did die last week after a battle with cancer. He was 82 years old. Widely regarded as one of football's greatest players, Pelé spent nearly two decades enchanting fans and dazzling opponents as football's most prolific scorer with Brazilian club Santos and the Brazilian national team as well. I mean, Pelé, as a non-soccer fan, for me, was the only guy that I knew. Right, it's Pelé and David Beckham, and then the new guy with the short hair and the fancy haircut. So Pele's fame was such that the 1967 factions of civil war in Nigeria agreed to a brief ceasefire so he could play an exhibition match in their country. That's how big he was. Needless to say, he's a legend. And FIFA's president Gianni Infantino, he wants to honor Pele in a very bold way.
And we need to make sure that we and the world of football remembers Pelé forever as well. And for this reason, of course, we pay tribute to him by being here. We pay tribute to him by asking all the federations now to pay a minute of silence and tribute to Pelé. But we're also going to ask every country in the world to name one of their football stadiums with the name of Pelé.
Okay, so FIFA is going to ask every country in the world to name a stadium after Pelé. In April 2021, Rio de Janeiro abandoned plans to name the famous
Maracanã.
How do they do? Maracanã?
Yes, there you go.
Hey. Wow, that is... I got the emphasis all wrong. Stadium after Pelé, after it was vetoed by the state governor. The largest soccer-specific stadium in Canada, BMO Field, was built on this site of the old exhibition stadium where the Toronto Blue Jays played, 77-89, as well as the Canadian football team, the Argos, between 59 and 88. It's a great place for concerts still. And so should Canada have to have a Pelé stadium because FIFA says so? Sounds like a very FIFA thing to do.
It is a very FIFA thing. Like, it's just the fact that it's coming from FIFA makes me kind of throw up in my mouth
cringe,
a bit,
right?
You know, it's just cringe. But the sentiment I actually don't necessarily disagree with. He's that big of a legend. And also it's difficult because soccer is the most global sport in the world is soccer, right? And so it's kind of like, you know, we wouldn't ask every country in the world to name a stadium after Wayne Gretzky because it's kind of Canada, it's a North American thing. And so
you've got Norway, Sweden, you've got Czechia, Germany, Ukraine, and all Europe. There's all kinds of hockey playing countries that aren't going to have a Wayne Gretzky.
Nope.
Exactly. They might have a Jaromir Jagr in Europe if Czechoslovakia or Czechia or wherever it is now.
It's, you know? it's more local, but Pelé's influence is incredibly global. But I will say that I don't think we should have to name a stadium after him. Now, we've got the World Cup coming to Canada in, is it 4 years or 2 years from now? 2026, I think.
3.5 years.
3.5 years, right? Now, if we build a new center and name it after him, I think that's totally cool. That's fine as part of the upcoming World Cup.
I think it's Canadian. But, you find a Canadian and you name it after a Canadian. I mean, if you want to have Pele's Pub or whatever, good for you. And if you want to have if FIFA said, hey, if this is an official FIFA venue, we want a memorial for Pele in every venue. And we're going to give you the money to here for the statue. We're going to give you the money for the memorial. It's got to be this big. Then fine.
Yeah.
I don't think that I don't think that from Zurich, FIFA, of all of the different organizations inside FIFA that have been accused of selling their votes for cash to send the World Cup to places, gets to come in and turn the name of BMO. Plus, who's going to pay for the BMO sponsorship to Pele Field in Toronto?
Yeah.
Like, that's like, that makes no sense to me. Like, if they want to say, put like in Edmonton, the Wayne Gretzky statue, right? That was great. Perfect. Well done. You're not going to put that into Winnipeg,
Montreal,
or Toronto, right?
No, it's weird.
You're not. So
it's weird.
Like downtown. Can you imagine if the Canucks lost in a final for the Stanley Cup against the Boston Bruins and there happened to be a Wayne Gretzky statue outside? Police cars would not be the only things upside down and on fire. So, like, none of this makes sense to me. I think this is wildly offside. And I think salute Pele. Okay, let's talk to Mr. Football. Tio Leo. Uncle Leo's in Vancouver. Am I offside with that, thinking that in Canada, they're if you want to do a tribute, they can fund a tribute, sure. But I think it's offside in places like that.
Yeah, I think you have a point. I think if you were to do this in North America, there are places you can do, like in New York, where Pele played, was
great idea.
Like with the Cosmos, right? That's why they hired him to make soccer popular in America, in the U.S. Yeah. And the way he
succeeded. If you had a David Beckham thing, do it in L.A., right? Was the Galaxy or whatever he played for, right?
Beckham, yes, and Pele played for the Cosmos.
Yeah, see, there you go. See, that makes sense to me. Okay, you're a soccer fan. I'm really not, right? So, although I'm learning, Leo, after watching Ted Lasso,
yeah,
I'm starting to like soccer more.
Yeah, it's nice. It's cool. Great sport.
It's great. Well, it's, I don't know if it's great. It's interesting. They're passionate. I'll give you that much. Holy cow. Are you okay with walruses? Who is it? Is it walry?
I looked this up. I'm really glad you asked, because walruses sounds wrong, but weird. It is correct. It is walruses. I thought it was walrusi, or if it was just a plural of a walrus, is a walrus. But no, it is walruses. And that is the correct grammar. Coming from me, of course, the king of grammar here.
You are the standard of high standards of grammar. So
yes, according to the big book of Google, walruses is the correct plural. Although if I'm wrong, I'm sure somebody will correct me in the
oh, they will. Even if you're not wrong, somebody will correct you. Don't worry. Yeah. They got big noses, lots of whiskers, big old tusks, floppy feet. You know, they can be mean, but aside from that, high five for the walrus.
Yeah, I'd agree.
All right. The walrus is a walrus on a very long journey. Drew huge crowds in northern England on New Year's Eve. He made a little pit stop in Scarborough. But the crowds had to leave without seeing New Year's Eve fireworks because they could have scared the walrus. The decision to cancel the event was made on the advice of British Divers Marine Life Rescue, the BDMLR, who have been monitoring the marine mammal wherever he goes. Wildlife experts suggested that the walrus, nicknamed Thor, I think Tiny is a better nickname, but hey, whatever, was taking a break before heading north, but the residents of Scarborough didn't seem to mind. They were just stoked to see Thor.
Thor left his Arctic homeland and was first spotted in Zeeland in the Netherlands before swimming past Belgium and into France. He stopped over in Dieppe and was then seen in Pouguier before nipping across the channel to Calshot in Hampshire. 19 days later, he popped up in Scarborough. Now he's off again, presumably and hopefully heading north. So he's here for about 18 hours or so?
Yeah, he came in, we think, about 10:30 on Friday night, and then was here till about 4:30 yesterday afternoon, so about 18 hours.
Thankfully, there were no welfare concerns for Thor. He might be far from home, but otherwise he seems to be perfectly healthy.
He's off course, yeah. For some reason, he's decided to leave the Arctic, go for a wander, you know, wandering walrus, for a better word, and now he's heading back north in the right direction. So probably the mistake he made was leaving the Arctic in the first place, wherever he actually was, going south and hope to now reorientate him back north, up to where he belongs.
His visit certainly caused a splash for those lucky enough to see him.
What was he like? Did he look happy?
He looked very happy. He was very relaxed and enjoying the stardom, I believe.
So for the New Year dippers, no need to share the water.
That only thing that would make me swim faster, I think, if that were chasing me. What a size that was.
Did you see the walrus?
Yeah.
What was he doing?
Snoring.
You know, a first for Scarborough, and I believe a first for Yorkshire as well. So we're very proud that he chose Scarborough to have a nap.
He lost me at the end, got to tell you.
Just the accent? Or
yeah, the accent lost me.
The nerth. I can't do it, but it's just so... I love it. It's a weird accent, and I love hearing it, even though I can't understand. I can understand Scottish better than I can that right there.
There are no T's in that alphabet, that's for sure.
No.
That report, by the way, was from Sky News. According to the BBC, the surrounding coastline was being monitored in case he reappeared, adding he was probably looking for a feeding ground. Officials, or maybe he was looking for fireworks, folks. Maybe he just wanted to see some fireworks, and then he showed up, and you turn him off. You don't know. You didn't ask Walter, the Thor guy. Okay. Officials are urging people not to go and see Thor, but said anyone coming across a walrus should allow plenty of space and keep dogs on leads and well away. There we go. I was trying to, as we were doing that, in Hawaii, I think it's the elephant seal, if I remember correctly. When that shows up, they shut down everything. I think that's what it is. Maybe I'm wrong. Oh, the monk seal. Is it the monk seal? I don't know. There's this big bugger, and he shows up. And when they do that, there's volunteers all over the island. And he goes, and they rope it off. Like he kind of saunters. I don't know. What is it? They saunter flops. Their way up the beach, flops. And then lies down, has a little nappy poo in the morning sun right on the beach. And so the volunteers come around with cones and it looks like police tape, and they rope the whole thing off. And you're not allowed to go anywhere near the beast while he's sleeping. And so, it's kind of cool to protect them. Like, I get that part. But I don't know. Maybe he was there to see fireworks. I'm just saying. 877-399-9898. What is the best pub you've ever been to? We want to call it out. We want to support them. We want to talk about the pubs. Now, before we get to that, we'll do one more. Are you okay with moving? We talked about renting. What about moving? We want to know, are okay with moving?
Are okay.
We got a typo, but are you okay? It's four letters,
yeah.
Right?
Hey, that's a typo. Yeah, that's a minor inconvenience, isn't it? I hate moving. It sucks. The excitement, though, is real. I think it's, you know, that first night where everything's in. You haven't unpacked yet, but you're in the new place. That's kind of cool and all that. But all in all, the whole process of moving is gross and almost endless. There's a box I still haven't unpacked from when I moved into this place because I have no place to put all the stuff in it.
So a box.
I'd like to avoid that. And box.
You need to come see my basement. My whole basement is filled with 10 years of marriage things that I have not unpacked.
Yikes. Yeah. I would avoid that.
Avoid that.
at all costs, by the way. Okay, so it's never easy to move. We've complained about all the costs associated with all of it. Ryan is lost without shelving. I mean, just lost. Completely. A little help can go a long way. Now, some criminals, though, down in the States asked the wrong people for help this week. Get ready, folks. This is our first official Florida story of 2023, and we're only 4 days in.
Two burglars in Central Florida were busted because they called 911. The Polk County Sheriff's Office says the duo called 911 to get help moving their belongings from a home they broke into. Deputies realized that no one lived at the house. The man and his girlfriend who called them had entered through an unlocked door. It turns out the man was already wanted for a Dollar General store burglary earlier that day, but the man and woman are facing charges.
All right, so there are some Floridians who needed some help moving stuff this week. What could possibly go wrong? Well, I can tell you what can go wrong. This clip should have played first.
I don't know how things work in Florida, which from your description sounds like a colorful, lawless swamp.
The previous report was from CBS Miami. Oh, I don't have the song. I feel like I should have the song, even though it's from the wrong show. Right?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Miami
Where'd it
Vice?
Go?
It was in the big book of sound CSI, effects.
CSI Miami. I have it here somewhere.
Look up by sunglasses.
This is terrible. Look up sunglasses. Oh, no, I have Law
and
Order.
First thing that comes to mind.
That's not right. Well, we're here. We might as well try to figure this out. I mean, we've completely fallen off the rails anyway. So why wouldn't we?
As is tradition.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is kind of what this is all about anyway. We've totally lost the story at this point anyway. Oh, well. Would appear that we've lost it now forever. Who knew?
We'll find it.
That can't be good. All right. Anyway, apparently this couple that was moving also wanted a ride to New York. Deputies did help them with their belongings and did give them a ride, but it wasn't to the airport. It was to the Poke Pokey, the sheriff's office said in a Facebook post. The area of Florida is called Poke Pokey. Okay. The post continues to say, and they are welcome to stay there all weekend. Poke Pokey is much better than New York anyway. Don't steal stuff. There's been a lot of scams of people, you know, like you come and pick up my stuff and move it. Then it never arrives at the new place and they put it in storage and basically extort you until you give them more money to give you the stuff back. That's not cool. I feel like we got to do this to save it. Oh!
Hey! There it is. That's the
Found
Florida.
It. Nice. I called it the Horatio clip. That's why.
Oh, okay. That yeah, I would have guessed sunglasses, yeah, or Miami. So, okay. Horatio it is. Makes sense. All
right. Thanks for listening to the Shift Podcast.
Make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the show and share with anyone you like. Get it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CuriousCast.ca.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.